It's The Takeaway for March 10th, and I'm Duarte Geraldino. Today on the show, Muslim American voters have their say in the presidential primary.
This is a position that, quite frankly, Muslims and Arab Americans are simply, you know, not used to.
Plus, in Mexico, a day without women, hashtag Un Día Sin Mujeres, brings attention to gender-based violence in the country.
The streets I walked around in, and mostly commercial, were eerily empty, and I think it underscored how much of the city is, you know, operated and occupied by women.
And finally, what single-use plastic bags mean for the environment and for you.
It made me want to carry more reusable bags and be a little more conscious of how many plastic bags I do use.
We start with Big Tuesday. Let's get to it.
Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, Idaho, Washington State, you will be heard.
I think the American people in this incredibly complicated and difficult moment in our history are entitled to thoughtful answers to the crises we face.
Today is the second big multi-state contest of the Democratic primary, and there's a lot at stake. People in six states vote today. Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders are the two frontrunners remaining. Now, for Senator Sanders, this is a chance to show that he's still competitive in this primary. He's hoping some Michigan momentum might give him the type of upset he had in 2016 when he beat Hillary Clinton in that state despite lagging in the polls by double digits beforehand. The Muslim vote is key in Michigan. Sanders has so far been dominating it. And on Super Tuesday, he won almost 60% of the Muslim vote. That's more than double the support Muslim voters showed Joe Biden.
In Arabic, uncle, you say Ammu. So when I say Ammu, you say Bernie. Ammu!
Bernie.
Ammu!
Bernie.
I say Habibi, you say Bernie. Habibi!
Bernie.
Habibi!
Bernie.
Now, there are only about 1 to 200,000 Muslim voters in Michigan, but if this turns out to be a close contest, Muslim voters could be the deciding factor. But is it enough to help Bernie Sanders pull off an upset in Michigan and change the course of this race? And why are Muslim Americans supporting Bernie Sanders in such large numbers? Joining us to discuss this is Aisha Khan. She's a reporter at the Religious News Service. And Yousef Shahood is also here. He's a political science professor at Christopher Newport University. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be with you.
Aisha, why have Muslim voters been supporting Bernie Sanders in such large numbers compared to other candidates in this race?
The issue is there's a desire for structural change. Biden has kind of presented himself and marketed himself as a candidate who will provide consistency, a return to normalcy is his phrase. There's no desire for normalcy to go back to that era for Muslim Americans. There's the desire for just to turn the political system upside down and build from the start in a way that Senator Sanders has really promised.
Turning the political system upside down, Yousef. That's how Aisha portrays it. Now, Dearborn, Michigan is home to the largest Muslim population in the United States. How do you think that will factor into the primary?
Well, you know, Muslims as a percentage of the American population are a fairly small proportion. So they're never going to be a so-called swing vote on a national scale. But when you narrow the scope geographically, and particularly when you think about state level races and primaries within states, well, then they actually have a chance at that point to effectively move the needle. Yeah, last time around in the 2016 primary in Michigan, the Arab American and Muslim American vote was credited in part with giving candidate Sanders at that time his surprise win. Now, the polls this time around seem equally, if not perhaps a bit more challenging for Bernie Sanders. So we'll have to see how it goes. But certainly the turnout among Muslim and Arab Americans will be decisively for Bernie Sanders.
You mentioned they may not be a deciding vote on a national level, but so much of politics is local. And right now we live in an era where cities and towns are really redefining what America is. So when you look at Dearborn, Michigan, and you say that Muslim Americans could be a swing vote in that area, That becomes especially significant, Youssef.
This is a position that, quite frankly, Muslims and Arab Americans are simply, you know, not used to, both in the sense of just being considered a voting constituency that needs to be acknowledged and courted, and being considered as a constituency worthy of reaching out to, and not simply a community that gets, you know, talked about when certain negative headlines reach the broader media.
Aisha, you heard Youssef talk about Muslim Americans being a constituency that some politicians have to look at as being worthy of reaching out to. How has Bernie Sanders supported the Muslim community when, to be frank, it wasn't always politically advantageous to do so?
Right. So when Barack Obama was campaigning, there was a famous incident where two hijab-wearing Muslim women appeared behind him at a rally, and some of his staff removed them. That's kind of been the traditional way of looking at Muslims. You know, you don't want to be too closely aligned with them, especially somebody like Obama, who already had these kinds of rumors swirling about him. But you don't see that with Senator Sanders, which has really been an incredible experience for a lot of Muslim Americans. For example, you see Linda Sarsour, who since 2016 has been his campaign surrogate. You know, she's caught a lot of heat for a lot of her statements on Palestine her involvement in the Women's March and other things. But you've never seen Bernie try to pull her out or try to hide his association with her. His campaign manager is the first Muslim American to be the head of a major campaign in the U.S., which really is a big, stunning change for Muslim Americans to see that kind of consideration.
Youssef, how, in your view, is Senator Sanders' campaign different from, say, President Barack Obama's when it comes to the Muslim vote?
You know, as Aisha mentioned, you know, there was that incident in Detroit, and many of your, you know, listeners may not really recall it. However, within the American Muslim community, this was shared widely. Now, to President Obama's credit, they apologized. It was the act of volunteers, and the campaign went and rectified that afterwards. But it does speak to this, you know, symbolic and oftentimes, you know, actual distance between the Obama administration and American Muslims. And you know, another case in point is President Obama didn't visit an American mosque until very late in his second term in office. Khaled Beydoun, a law professor and Detroit native, noted the other day that Bernie Sanders visited somewhere in the vicinity of perhaps, you know, half a dozen mosques when he went talk to Muslims during the Michigan primary in 2016. And if that's the case, then he visited more mosques just in that one stint in Michigan than both President Obama and President Bush did during their entire terms in office. So that is really sick. Bernie Sanders is really putting his money where his mouth is. Like, he's not simply talking the talk. I mean, he really is, you know, trying to not just simply reach out to Muslim voters, but, genuinely comes across to Muslim voters that he actually cares about their well-being.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the impact of the Muslim vote. So, you know, there's this narrative that is always seems to be on autoplay in the USA of Jews versus Muslims. And it is on repeat. Given that narrative, Aisha, how does Muslim support for Senator Sanders, who is Jewish, challenge that?
I think this is something that a lot of folks, you know, even within my newsroom, have been surprised by this fervor that Muslim American voters have for Bernie Sanders, that, oh, you know, isn't he Jewish or isn't he atheist or whatever? You know, he is Jewish. You know, why are Muslim Americans supporting him? But Muslim Americans themselves are not at all surprised by that idea. It's, you know, there's a long history of Jewish-Muslim solidarity in America. And actually, it's Senator Sanders, who is a Jewish American, who has the most progressive vision for the Palestine-Israel conflict. And, you know, that doesn't go far enough for most Muslim American voters that I talk to. They wish that he would go further, but they recognize that he has, you know, a history. His family was deeply affected by the Holocaust, and that resonates with them, that, you know, he comes from a background that really understands the toll, and that really resonates with American Muslims.
Yusuf, what are some of the other issues that Muslim communities in particular are prioritizing, and how does that line up with the Sanders platform?
You know, his economic policies, certainly healthcare, but also tuition and just his more broader economic justice plan appeals to a large segment of the Muslim population who are not really experiencing the American dream, as it were. Somewhere in the vicinity of 1/3 of Muslim households are at or below the federal poverty level. And so the economic realignment that a Sanders administration would put forward is very appealing, both to these lower income households within the Muslim community, but also for those in the Muslim community that value social justice more broadly.
Aisha, it's a sensitive topic, but the issue of surveillance in Muslim American communities in the USA can be touchy. How is the shadow of that issue affecting voters during this primary?
I think the most prominent place that you saw it was definitely the reaction to Mayor Bloomberg's candidacy. He immediately apologized upon announcing his candidacy for stop and frisk because there's so much pressure was put on him, but he didn't apologize for the warrantless surveillance of New York and New Jersey area Muslims, just across the board, restaurants, mosques, Muslim student associations at universities. And he didn't apologize for that, and he actually continued defending it during his campaign. Now that he's out of the race, I think it's coming down to Biden's record as part of the Obama administration versus that of what Sanders is promising. Under the Obama administration, the Countering Violent Extremism federal program was kind of enacted, implemented nationally, which ostensibly partnered with grassroots Muslim community leaders and tried to guide young Muslims away from the path of radicalization. But in fact, that really kind of created a lot of friction between the White House and law enforcement, as well as Muslims. And Muslims kind of saw themselves as, why are we being the sole focus of this countering violent extremism policy, as opposed to, white nationalists and other sorts of domestic extremism. And Sanders has really talked about moving away from that model and instead focusing on white nationalism as the biggest threat within the U.S. in terms of extremism.
Aisha Khan is a reporter at Religious News Service. Yusuf Shahood is a political science professor at Christopher Newport University. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having me.
Women, girls, mothers, daughters, and sisters. They are being murdered in Mexico at an astounding rate. The people who study this call it gender-based violence. It's also known as femicide. And last year, more than 1,000 women were killed in Mexico. That's nearly 10 women or girls every day. Mexican women are fighting back, taking to the streets, demanding the world recognize the threats that they live under. And after a string of killings in the past few months, some so gruesome involving torture and mutilation, Mexico is seeing some of the biggest protests in recent history. Tens of thousands of women and their supporters marched this Sunday on International Women's Day. And on Monday, women took part in a national strike called A Day Without Us. Many women stayed home, refused to work, to demonstrate the power women actually hold in the country. Meet Andalusia Knowles-Soloff. She's a freelance journalist in Mexico. Hi, Andalusia.
Hi.
So we know there's a femicide crisis in Mexico. How long has it been unfolding?
The femicide crisis actually has been unfolding over the past 30 years. It first became known to the world in Ciudad Juarez, which is a border city on the U.S.-Mexico border in northern Mexico. And it's a city where many women migrated from all across Mexico to work in factories and maquiladores. And then at some point, their bodies started showing up in the desert there. And these cases were not investigated. The government often said, or the police would say that, oh, they just went off with their boyfriend. And the families kept insisting that their daughters did not just go away, that someone had either kidnapped them or killed them. And then finally, they were able to pressure the government enough to investigate. But that was only because they also took it to international courts. And it was a case called the cotton field case, because there were some women who were found in a cotton field. It was in an international human rights case in which, I think it was 2010, they dictated that the Mexican government was responsible for the murder of these women because they did not properly investigate it, and also the conditions just of security in general. And the Mexican government was supposed to take a series of measures to change the situation. But today, 10 years later, not only do women keep being killed in Ciudad Juarez, but now 10 women are being killed every single day all across Mexico.
So we know that there are some women who are killed and their deaths are not marked as femicides. Is there a specific definition that would mark a particular murder a femicide as opposed to just a homicide?
Yes. Femicide, which is a term that was created by the feminist Marcela Lagarde, is a term that describes a hate crime against a woman when a woman is being murdered for being a woman, and it was incorporated into the penal code in Mexico in 2012, but it actually depends on the state, so it's not the same in every state, but generally it is considered a femicide if the woman is killed by someone who she had a relationship with, either an intimate relationship or a familial relationship, or if the woman's body was left in a public place, which is very, very common in Mexico, or if before the woman was murdered that she was kidnapped or disappeared for some time. And then also if there is sexual violence involved or if there were incidents of violence before she was murdered. So it depends a little on every state, but that more or less are the reasons in which a femicide is defined as a femicide. And also it's important to note that there are often cases of femicide where the government does not properly investigate and says it's a suicide. There's a case of Marina Buendia, who was murdered by her husband and strangled, and the government said it was a suicide. Her mother, often it's the mothers who become the investigators and the forensic experts in these cases to find justice for their daughters. She said that she knew that her daughter did not commit suicide, and she actually brought the case all the way up to the Mexican Supreme Court, where they then dictated that both they had to reopen the case where her husband was eventually prosecuted. But what this meant is that they said that every single violent death of a woman in Mexico must be investigated as a femicide. They can then decide that it wasn't a femicide, but from the get-go, they must be investigated by femicides. Unfortunately, that still does not happen, but on the books, that is what legally should happen when a woman meets a violent death.
Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador ran on a progressive campaign and has been in office since December 2018. How has his administration reacted to the crisis of femicide?
He has definitely come very short of responding to this crisis. And if he is responding to the crisis, it's because civil society is responding to the crisis and that women are taking to the streets en masse to protest this administration. I was just a few days ago in Michoacán, in Morelia, which is a very conservative city where there's hardly ever any protests, and more than 3,000 women took to the streets in protest, and that was just in one city. That happened in cities all over the country. He did say yesterday, he has a morning press conference every day, where he said, oh, I do support their right to protest, but he also said, I do think, though, there are many conservative elements that are being disguised behind the feminist movement. And he has said many things like this over the past month, where he thinks that it's people that are trying to attack his government and his government, which is called the Fourth Transformation of Mexico, that they are trying to shut this transformation down disguised by these women's movements. And he really has not neither shown sympathy for the victims. We've had a series of really serious public cases of women being murdered over the past few months, one including the murder of a 7-year-old girl who was kidnapped outside of her school and found dead and naked in a bag a week later. And he has not shown any kind of empathy or sympathy with the families. He has not put forward a strategy for security. The one thing that has happened, and this I would not say came from him, is that there is a new investigative fiscal in the government that will investigate femicides. And it is actually someone who is fit to do this. Her name is Sayuri Herrera, and she is a lawyer who has specialized in femicides and actually worked on a very well-known case, which is of Lesbi Rivera Berlin, who was found dead on the UNAM campus with a telephone cord. This is the largest university in the country. She was found with a telephone cord around her neck, and the government said it was suicide. And thanks to Sayuri and her lawyer team and the family, they were able to prove that she was murdered by her boyfriend, who now is in prison for femicide. So hopefully this new investigative team of the government, and with Sayuri as the fiscal, will be looking further into this femicide crisis.
Andalucía Knowles-Soloff is a freelance journalist based in Mexico. Andalucía, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on. You can follow me at Andalalucha, and I'm always there writing about and publishing about gender violence in Mexico.
We just heard how women in Mexico are taking to the streets to protest gender-based violence in the country. Some people say the way local Mexican newspapers cover violence sometimes makes the situation worse. Suman Naishadam is a freelance reporter based in Mexico. She recently wrote an article for Al Jazeera about femicide and Mexican media. Suman, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Duarte. How are you?
Now, Suman, you recently wrote a piece for Al Jazeera where you talk about the media and how their display of some of the images of gender-based violence is offensive to a lot of people. Can you describe that in more detail?
So the story I wrote was on the Nota Roja, or Red Sheets, these graphic crime tabloids that feature uncensored photos of the dead, often with lewd headlines, not unlike something you might see in the New York Post or Daily Mail if, you know, they covered this kind of thing and ran it on their front page. And the photos are usually next to other photos of sports stars and nude models. And last month, two Mexico City Nota Roja papers came under fire when they printed a leaked photo of the 25-year-old femicide victim, Ingrid Escamilla. When they published leaked photos of her corpse on their front pages, it was a brutal image, and one paper ran the full image under the headline, "It was Cupid's fault," in an allusion to a crime of passion that happened near Valentine's Day. So the publication of this photo, you know, definitely touched a nerve, and there were many women who felt that they exploited the bodies of women. And in a protest not long after, the delivery truck of one of these papers was torched, slogans like "the press is complicit" were sprayed around the city and in, you know, the downtown area where one of these papers has their offices. And so that was kind of the controversy there. And a few days after they ran that photo, one of the papers, La Prensa, had, you know, run a separate cover reiterating their commitment to telling ugly stories, and as they always have, but also recognized that it needs to dialogue with society and that they heard the protesters' pleas, they heard society's pleas.
It's so difficult, to be frank, for me to look at these images because they're traumatic. And the fact that the headline, based on what you're telling me, read, "It was Cupid's fault," where they showed the dead, mutilated body of a 25-year-old woman. And right next to that image was an image of a scantily clad living woman also portraying the sort of sexuality. Do I understand that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what they sell. And clearly, they're very popular, though some people consider them to be, these papers to be targeted more for men. They're also much cheaper than prestige newspapers in Mexico. They cost around 8 pesos, the Nota Roja, and, you know, a more serious newspaper that doesn't feature such images on its covers, you know, is more around 20 pesos. And in Mexico City, the most famous Nota Roja, called La Prensa, sells an average of over 287,000 physical copies a day in Mexico City. So that obviously speaks to its popularity. But there are also many who find these images jarring and distasteful. And, you know, I think from conversations, do their best to avoid looking at them while passing newsstands.
And is there any, I mean, did you speak to some of these newspapers? What do they say in their defense? How do they justify this business model, continuing to produce these papers that show such graphic images of violence against women right next to hypersexualized images?
Yeah, so the paper whose editor I spoke with, La Prensa, you know, he was saying that, and the reporters as well that I spoke with of that same paper were saying that, you know, the public has a right to know what happens, and that obviously there are very ugly things happening in terms of crime in Mexico and Mexico City, you know, right now. And as far as the sexualizing women part, you know, they said that they've actually come down in the number of photos of scantily clad women that they feature on their covers, and it's not as often as it used to be in the past. And I think they justify or, you know, defend their work because of an appetite for gore that readers evidently have, and, you know, their relationship with readers. And this is a 91-year-old paper. It's, you know, it's somewhat of an institution, really.
Thank you so much. Suman Naishadam is a freelance reporter based in Mexico City.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
Thank you.
What's up with our elections in 2020? Why do some states caucus and others don't? Who gets to be a delegate? And yes, everyone goes crazy about Super Tuesday, but what is it and why is it so important? I'm Amy Walter, host of How to Vote in America, a new podcast from WNYC Studios. Every episode, we'll tackle one element of this long and twisted election process and try to make sense of what it actually takes to vote in this country. Listen to How to Vote in America wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway, and I'm Duarte Giraldito. For most of your life, when you bought groceries, you probably brought home carrots, cheese, maybe potatoes, but all of it in plastic bags. Those bags have a significant environmental impact, and recently, New York became the latest state to institute a ban on single-use plastic bags. Now, there will be some exceptions to this, but overall, the aim is to cut down on the state's plastic consumption. According to New York's Department of Environmental Conservation, New Yorkers had been using roughly 23 billion plastic bags per year. California and Oregon also have statewide plastic bag bans, and cities across the country have implemented bans and taxes on the bags. And you've been talking to us about this.
Yeah, I used to live in Brooklyn, but I'm up in Amherst, Massachusetts now at graduate school, and there's a plastic bag ban that's been in effect for 4 years, and it's great. I love it. I just always have bags in my car. Sometimes I get the paper bags at the grocery stores, and I use those for my trash and recycling. Hopefully, we'll see a good shift as more bans happen across the country.
Well, here in Oregon, we've had single-use plastic bag bans for quite a while. As of 2020, a statewide ban went into effect. So far, I think it's been going well. It's the fact that it's 5 cents for a bag doesn't seem to be a huge problem. It is a habit that we all have to build. Hopefully, we'll see more as time goes on. I'd love to hear about other states and their data.
These plastic bag bans mean a lot for consumers and for the environment. Tatiana Hamanoff is an assistant professor of economics and public policy at New York University. Thanks for being here, Tatiana.
Thanks for having me.
And Julia Stein is the project director for the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA School of Law. Good to have you with us, Julia.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Julia, in 2014, the Earth Policy Institute, which is an environmental nonprofit organization, estimated that we use about 1 trillion plastic bags globally per year. What are the environmental impacts of producing these bags, and what tends to happen when we throw them out?
Yeah, so, I mean, the environmental and human health impacts of plastic bags are severalfold. So, you know, at this point, there are about 700 species that are affected by plastics, including about 84% of sea turtle species. And what can happen is that marine wildlife can mistake plastic bags for food, and so they'll ingest them, and then ultimately that leads to their deaths. But plastic also breaks down in water, and so humans are now exposed to plastics in our water, in our table salt, in our seafood. These plastic particles have been found in most water systems in the United States. And plastic also has climate change impacts. So plastic is a petroleum product, and studies are also showing that plastic releases greenhouse gases as it breaks down in landfills as well. But plastic production is on the rise. By some estimates, the greenhouse gas impacts of the petrochemical industry will increase by 30% by 2050. And there are, of course, other environmental consequences to plastic production, like the emission of other chemicals into the air and water as part of the production process.
Tatiana, New York State is completely banning thinner plastic bags, but not the thicker ones or paper ones. Based on your research, how effective is this sort of ban?
So the city of Chicago placed a ban that was nearly identical to New York State's ban, which, again, thin plastic bags will no longer be available in grocery stores. But these policies leave other types of disposable bags unregulated. Stores can offer paper bags, or they could also offer thicker paper plastic bags for free, which is what we saw many retailers do in Chicago, leading to potentially an increase in the amount of plastic used.
So if we could look at a different part of the country, Julia, California banned single-use plastic bags in 2016. How does that ban compare to New York's?
Sure. So California's ban is a little bit different. And like Tatiana mentioned, you know, in New York, there is no mandatory fee component to other types of single-use bags, like thicker plastic bags or paper bags that are going to be used in stores. And so, you know, at what we've seen in situations like that is that consumers will sometimes use that other option. And that doesn't necessarily decrease environmental impact. By contrast, California's law applies a mandatory fee to other types of single-use bags. And so CalRecycle, our state agency that's responsible for waste management here, shows that that setup has dramatically changed customer behavior. So now in about 86% of transactions, customers will bring their own bags in California.
Tatiana, we know that some cities are opting for a tax on plastic and paper bags instead of an outright ban. And you have spoken with consumers in Washington, D.C. after that plastic bag tax went into effect. How effective are the taxes?
So the taxes, like the ones in Washington, D.C., have been incredibly effective at decreasing all disposable bag use, not just plastic bags, largely because these are policies that regulate all types of disposable bags, thick plastic and thin plastic and paper. And we saw a 42 percentage point decrease in the likelihood of using a disposable bag after that tax went into effect. Consumers that I spoke to say that this is a policy that they actually support, that it's effective because it is sort of a pain. They don't want to pay 5 cents, but they also support it. It encourages them to remember to bring a reusable bag, which is a behavior that they always mean to do and just forget to do.
When we talk about behavior, so much of this involves consumer behavior. Julia, some people use those so-called single-use plastic bags twice, once to bring home their groceries and then again to bag their trash. How much of a concern is it that once you ban these types of single-use plastic bags, consumers are just going to be buying more products like plastic garbage bags?
Sure, which are, of course, not banned under the ban. But, you know, I think one thing to bear in mind is that these are things that really can only be used once or twice at best. And we're really trying to shift consumer behavior away from using those types of products. Some single-use products, like single-use plastic bags, are both unnecessary and particularly challenging to recycle. So plastic bags are a prime example. They gum up waste management, plant works, and they can't be fully recycled, so they're a prime target for a ban.
So why not focus on the companies producing these instead of just the consumers?
So I think the important thing to bear in mind is that source control is important. Much of the conversation has been focused on recycling to date, but there's not as much recycling going on as you think. Only about 10% of plastic waste is recycled. And with countries that used to accept our plastic waste, like China, closing their doors, the U.S. is left without adequate waste management infrastructure to process all of our plastic waste. So, you know, we have to change consumer behavior as well as asking producers to take responsibility for the waste that they're generating as well.
And Tatiana, very briefly, a tax on these bags, could they disproportionately impact low-income communities?
So many of the policies do have an exception for customers who are shopping using SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or WIC. These are two nutritional assistance programs used by low-income households. But what my research shows is that if you're a policymaker that is concerned about the financial burden on low-income communities, some of these very small taxes can still have a very large effect on consumer behavior. So why not levy a very small tax instead of a larger one? And you still might get those environmental benefits without creating financial burdens on low-income shoppers.
Tatiana Hamanoff is an assistant professor of economics and public policy at New York University, and Julia Stein is the project director for the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA School of Law. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for today. You can follow me on Twitter at Duarte Geraldino. Also, if you missed anything and want to listen again, check out our podcast. And of course, call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Duarte Geraldino. This is The Takeaway.